Good morning, everyone. You are true stalwarts, and I'm really gratified and honored to be speaking with you this morning. I hear there's a number of very exciting sessions going on at this very moment elsewhere at Greenbelt, and for you to come to the very big top on a Saturday morning is profoundly gratifying. So thank you very much for being here. I always end up saying the same thing at Greenbelt. I think this is Greenbelt number 4 or 5 for me and my wife, and now number 2 for my 2-year-old son. But I often say to friends that I think of Greenbelt as the best Muslim festival in Britain. And I say that because there are few places and few spaces that I, as a believer, look forward to being in as much as I do this one. This weekend in August is a highlight of our calendar. It's because the warmth and love, affection, camaraderie, honesty, dialogue, sharing that has happened over the years has made me a better person and has led me to question and to reassess and to recommit myself to faith. And I have really to thank Greenbelt for that, but also all the wonderful people, the thousands of people who come here and the hundreds I've had a chance to interact with. A final thank you before I jump right in to Michael Wakelin and the team at Coexist for making these kinds of spaces possible at Greenbelt. I think as the festival starts its next 40 years, it's going to increasingly become a space where these kinds of conversations and sharing take place. So thank you, Michael. Thank you, Coexist. And thank you, Greenbelt. Looking for Allah at 33 revolutions per minute. I think everyone knows a reference to 33 revolutions per minute. When I was young, we had a record player in our home. And amongst the first records that my parents played, besides Paul Anka and Neil Diamond, was sacred music from the subcontinent, was the music of the mystics and the music of the poets. It's music that kind of lodged in my heart and mind and has very much been part of my own spiritual journey and is deeply connected to the first questions that I think each and every one of us as believers ask ourselves, which is, when did I first perceive God? How did I know God? And for me, it begins between a name and music. My name is Abdurrahman, which literally means the slave of the merciful, one of the attributes of God that we will be looking at shortly. So in a way, God's name is sort of enmeshed and encoded in my own. But as my knowledge of my own faith grew and my experience of other faiths grew, there was a profound paradox that I had to deal with. For my Christian brothers and sisters, there was the very complex theology of God in human form. But there was a human element to God that I found that Christian friends could relate to in the person of Jesus Christ. For my friends who were Jewish, there was a deep commitment to law, knowing God through the laws. And of course, the example of Moses as someone who dialogued and debated and talked to God. When I looked at the Quran, and as the Quran became increasingly a part of my life, my own sacred scripture, there was a paradox. The testification of the Islamic faith is La ilaha illallah, means there is no ilah, no God, except Allah God. Then comes the ayah of the Quran, the verse of the Quran, which says part of it, Laytha kamithlihi shay, which in translation means there is nothing like unto God. Yet at the same time in my tradition, there's these amazingly personal, intimate passages about God, about Allah. God is closer to us, the Quran tells us, than our own jugular vein. One of the great spiritual sayings of the mystics is that nothing can contain God except the human heart. In one narration of the Prophet Muhammad, he says that God said to him, I was a treasure and wanted to be known, so created creation so I would be known. So Islam, on one hand, posits this kind of radical monotheism setting itself apart from Christianity and in some cases even Judaism. Yet at the same time, the relationship with God is an intimate one, a close one. He's here but separate from us, close but not like us, aware but different. The Quran tells us in a beautiful passage before we jump into the music. The Quran says, Allah is He, other than whom there is no God, who knows both what is hidden and what can be witnessed. He is the most compassionate, the merciful. Allah is He, other than whom there is no God, the sovereign, the one, the source of peace, the guardian of faith, the preserver of security, the exalted, the compelling, the supreme. Glory be to God beyond any associations. He is God, the creator, the evolver, the bestower of forms. To Him belongs the most beautiful names. Whatever exists in heaven and earth declares His praise and glory, and He is exalted in power, the wise. It is these beautiful names that have always compelled me, because I have one of them, Rahman, the merciful. It kind of belongs to me. It's my little piece of my relationship with God Almighty. The great mystic and Muslim scholar Al-Ghazali wrote a book about the most beautiful names, these attributes by which we know God. And he said something remarkable that to this day surprises me and intrigues me. And really from where we begin this journey through music. He said that while God is known through His names and His attributes, and those attributes are indications in the ways with which God deals and engages with His creation, at the same time, we have a share of those names. Each and every one of us, at various points in our lives, in the timeline of our lives, in various moments and contexts, each and every one of us has those names manifested in us. In a way, we have a share of those names. It's intriguing. The paradox remains. So what about music? Islamic sacred music is vast, and today I hope to introduce you to a few selections from around the world which dwell on some of these amazing, powerful, and beautiful names. But I want to tell you a story, and then we'll jump into the first song. There's a passage in the Quran which speaks about a moment in the time before time when all the souls, each and every one of us, and all those who have come before us, and all those who will come after us, and all those who are on this good earth today, where all the souls were gathered in their form as souls before the majesty of God, before the beauty of God, before the creative power of the great creator. And as we were all brought forward, a question was asked by God to us, the Quran says. In Arabic, the question is pithy and sharp. Alastu bi rabbikum. Am I not your Lord? And the Quran tells us that is as if we were a symphony, as if we were one voice made up of billions and billions of voices, that our voices arose together. And we said, Bala, of course, verily, obviously, yes, you are our Lord. It's said by the mystics that in that moment when we heard the symphony of all humankind and human creation to come, we heard an incredible music, and that music inscribed itself on our souls. And Rumi, the great mystic poet, says that each and every one of us has that encoded in our souls, and we, when we are born into this world, are like a reed cut from the reed bed. The reed, as you know, makes a beautiful flute. The reed flute, particularly in the Islamic mystical tradition, is universal. And that the reed flute, when it's blown into, has an amazing lament that calls to something deep, that calls to a great longing. And it is this longing that encourages us to make music, that encourages us to explore sound, and through it, to find some meaning. Master Ali Farka Touré for a moment, from Mali. We turn the sound up just a bit.
Malien bena komika ambo de faunye.
Let that play in the background. Just turn it down just a tad. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the great master of what has now become known as the African blues, Ali Farka Touré. I feel like I have a relationship with Ali Farka Touré. I first saw him in the summer of 2000 in Toronto. And my friend of mine was a journalist, and he was interviewing him. And it was an evening concert down by the water. And Ali was giving an interview through a translator. He was a terribly gregarious man, a bit larger than life, absolute salt of the earth. And in the middle of the interview, it was around 9 o'clock, and the set was going to begin at 9:30. And literally in mid-question, he said, "Enough. Sissa." He got up, he turned around, he faced Mecca, and he started praying. The prayer time had come in. Few people know that Ali Farka Touré was a profoundly religious man, a spiritual man. I had the opportunity to see his last concert before he died at the Barbican. And I remember this incredible smile on his face as he walked onto the stage of the Barbican, singing a song in praise of God and the Prophet Muhammad. Ali Farka Touré came from a family of griots, people who before the advent and coming of Islam had been the carriers of tradition, of the stories. And he continued that, to the point that at one point he became the mayor of his town, Niafunke, on the banks of the Niger River in Mali, and refused to record anymore. And when people like Rai Kuder and others came and said, "Ali, you got to record with us," he said, "If you want to record with me, you come to my village." And so they would drag their generators and everything else that's involved in recording, and they would drag it to his village, and he would record there. This song is an amazing song. And it was a song. It was the first song that I ever heard him sing live in Toronto so many years ago. Allah Uya. And I remember he had this wonderful orchestra with him, and he had these amazing female singers from his village. And Allah Uya means God is present. God is around us. God is everywhere. But the interesting thing about this song is that it actually is a political song. It was in a time after a civil conflict in Mali, a little different and less horrible than the one that we're witnessing today. His tribe had been engaged in this conflict. And this was his way of making peace. And the lyrics go something like, "We are letting you know that this thing that I'm saying, Allah Uya, this is what we, all Malians, we agree on." He said, this is something that is part of us and we are not separate from it. Wherever you go in Mali, Ali says, you find brotherhood, you find solidarity, you find dignity, you find equality, Allah Uya. Got me thinking. Here is one of the masters of the African blues. The blues came from West Africa. Arguably the root of all modern music that we are accustomed to and that we listen to finds its roots in West Africa. Down to the rhythmic structure of the music from there. And in fact, Ali hated calling his music, the blues, because he said it's more primordial than that. It's more original than that. Yet through this, here's God. We find God in the quote-unquote African blues. And the attribute of God that came to mind, especially as Ali's talking about power and politics, was the name of God Al-Malik, which means the king. In the Islamic conception of this attribute, we would say that it indicates that God is completely independent of all things. Not merely the master of all things, but absolutely separate from his creation. In fact, creation is dependent on God's active creative force in the universe and not the other way around. So what then can human beings share of this absolute kingship, this absolute sovereignty over all creation? Well, the mystic Al-Ghazali says that just as God has power over his kingdom, you and I also have a kingdom. And he said the kingdom is not land and it isn't wealth. But Al-Ghazali said that the kingdom are your limbs and your tongue and your mind and your heart, that these are your soldiers in the field of life. These are the things you employ and that you keep back. And he said that the one who has mastered this kingdom, one's heart, one's mind, one's limbs, and one takes all these soldiers, all these forces that one has and applies it to goodness and to service and to caring and to taking care of what one needs to take care of and of lifting up those who need to be lifted up and of holding oneself back when greed and avarice afflicts them, then one has really taken part of God's attribute, the king. It's fascinating. Raises some interesting theological questions, no doubt. But it's for me, it was fascinating that even this mighty name, we could have something of it. And I think, in a way, Ali was saying that. In a Mali, in a country broken apart by war, you have power. And that power is given to you by God because he's around us, he's present. Ali Farka Touré passed away several years ago, and I don't think we'll ever see someone like him again. As time passes, these traditions and these stories and these remarkable people, they seem irreplaceable. But we have his music, which is a great blessing indeed. I'll turn that up in a second. Many of you will be familiar with this particular musician, our second of five this morning. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan is part of a tradition from the subcontinent, and it's a tradition that I'm particularly familiar with because it's a tradition that I not only grew up with, but it's a tradition that comes from the place where my parents came from, in the Punjab. The Qawwali tradition is an ecstatic tradition. It's a tradition which takes the words of poets, mystic poets who brought Islam and the religion to my part of the world or the part of the world that my parents are from, and transformed the people there and transformed the culture. But this isn't something this is not staid religion. This is ecstatic religion. This is loud religion. This is religion that makes you lose oneself. This is religion that makes you dance. This is religion that frees yourself from your body and something else takes over. My father used to attend Qawwali music gatherings where Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan's father, another great master of this ecstatic poetic tradition, used to go, and he described scenes at the shrines of the mystics where grown men with long beards and turbans who otherwise would be seen as very dour, very proper, very conservative, hearing this music for 10, 15, 20 minutes would get up, begin to twirl and begin to yell and begin to shout and begin to dance because this is the music that moves the heart. So try to, as you listen to Nusrat, Fateh Ali Khan. I mean, close your eyes and maybe imagine what the music might be able to do. He's saying, God is, God is, God is. Allahu. It's not words. We give it words, but it's not words. It's breath. Allahu. Hu. It comes from a very deep part. It's like the breath flowing through you. And when the qawwali grows, and sometimes the same verses are repeated once, twice, three, four, dozen, two dozen times. You forget how many times they're being repeated because the message comes back again and again. And the heart takes over the mind. And in this particular qawwali, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan is speaking about creation before us. He's saying that before there was the sun and the moon and the stars, there was you. When this earth and the world did not exist, when the secret of the truth was still unknown, there was nothing. There was only you. And in this statement of only you, he's emphasizing that there was only you, there is only you, there will be only you. Our very being is contingent upon you. And yet, there's something remarkable about this qawwali, because in understanding God, he's calling on God's creation. So not just the sun and the moon and the stars, but the blades of grass, the trees, the saplings. In every leaf, he says, there is the signature of you. In the mountains, there is splendor of you. In the curiosity that we have to learn things, there is a desire for you. In the light of my eyes and in the expansiveness of my heart, there is you. Where there is an argument, there is you, because you resolve all arguments. It is a wonderful and bold statement of God. But again, it's the human being through this incredible poetry. In these statements, the poetry ceases to be words and just becomes notes. He's uttering notes because it's just about the rhythm of the music. Because even in the rhythm of that music and the moments in between, there is God. And Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan became a massive global sensation. He died in 1997. And once again, there has been nobody quite after him who has captured this tradition as he has. There's wonderful qawwali singers all over the world. But my editorial comment would be is that he was known in his life as Shahin Shahe Qawwal, which means that the king of the kings of qawwal, the sultans of qawwali music. And it is a title which he went to the grave with. And no doubt, I have no doubt in heaven, he is singing these words right now before God Almighty. And he will continue to sing for all eternity, because it's the kind of music and the kind of wonderful legacy that he left us. And the attribute that most comes to my mind is Al-Baqi, the everlasting. The everlasting presence, the eternal presence. And I think when we reflect on what our share of this is, we don't have a share of it, but we have a reflection of it on ourselves. That before this everlasting, mighty, majestic, beautiful presence, the kind of presence that produces music like this, I think to myself, it's humility, it's dependence. And whatever change occurs in us, it is because of the realization that we are close to God and God is near us. From Africa to the subcontinent, and now we return back to Europe. In the 1990s, many of us, and particularly my generation of young Muslims, came of age during the Bosnian conflict and the ethnic cleansing and genocide there. For us, as Western Muslims, for lack of a better term, for someone who has grown up in Canada, who felt so strongly part of the traditions of this part of the world, and of this part of the world, watching the slaughter of Muslims in Bosnia was a profound shock. Was a profound shock and was deeply disturbing. And it mobilized us and politicized us in a way that... interesting. Not part of our musical selection, although very pretty. It really politicized us and it changed us in a way. And we all of a sudden became aware of a Muslim experience much wider than South Asia and the Middle East. I think the world became aware of that. In the aftermath of the Bosnian, conflict, there's been an amazing resurgence of spirituality in Bosnia. And I want to introduce you to a quite a unique group, actually. They're called Kausar. Kausar is in Islamic tradition is a pool from one of the pools of paradise. Where a drink will satiate one for all eternity. And this is an amazing group. So I hope you can see the video, because this is a video. Oh.
There's nothing coming through here.
There's nothing coming down there. Let me see again. Oh, there we go. So there's a great tradition within Muslim cultures of the female voice. I would say that, unfortunately, particularly within the modern period, we've seen that tradition challenged. We've seen in some places that tradition crushed. But I think in many parts of the world, the tradition is not just alive, but is making an incredible resurgence. In Bosnia, the women's choir has become this a very important kind of a very important way in which a community that in many ways was separated from its spirituality has begun to express their spirituality again. This is a particularly lovely it's a lovely song and poem. Here's a translation very roughly. You wounded me this winter with this chill. I am a garden made from your wishes, so put bloom in my crown. As ivy bends, let me bend around the faith you have given me. Let me bind myself to your beauty. All the wind and storm Let them stoke my trees. In this battle, my roots, my submission will become stronger. The flame of yearning burns my heart. Nothing can extinguish it but the ocean of your love. Now, who is she speaking about? Well, what's really interesting, particularly about the way in which the tradition has spoken to God, is that, of course, God has no gender. Although the pronoun he is often used, which once again has created a kind of a contemporary discussion around language and gendered language. But what's interesting is that classical Islamic poetry often referred to God as in the female form. Not only was God referred to as a female form, God was often referred to as the lover or the beloved, as the one that one ardently aspired to. In many of the sacred odes of old, you had the stories of Layla and Majnun. Majnun, the mad lover. Layla, the perfect beauty. The perfect beauty, Layla, is often a stand-in for God. And so there is, in this relationship with a God who is not like us, upon whom our very reality is contingent, yet this kind of ardent, passionate desire. Often it's referred to, this desire is referred to in terms like the wine of desire and the explorations of wine and the one who gives the wine and the one who imbibes it and takes it. Very odd for a culture that says that wine is forbidden, by the way. So clearly there's something about this relationship with God, that this intimacy that one can have with God, that is dangerous, not almost forbidden, something that one approaches. And the greatest pleasure, of course, in this relationship is unity with God. It's called fana, when one is absorbed completely in the beloved, when one ceases to know themselves, but only to know the beloved and be surrounded by the beloved. It's almost sexual. And that is for some, even for some Muslims. I remember friends of mine when we were exploring Sufi poetry at university, some get shocked, almost scandalized. How can you speak about God like this? But it's very much part of the tradition. And it's once again this way through poetry and through experience that one approaches God. One of the great mystics of the early days, Rabia, a woman from Basra in modern-day Iraq, she used to say that if I desire you, God, for paradise, restrict paradise from me. And if I desire you because I fear hell, then throw me into hell. But if I desire you because I love you, then take me into your love. It was that kind of passion. And in this particular song by this Bosnian choir, again, it's the love of God, the oceanic love of God that can extinguish all dis-ease, that can extinguish all difficulty, that all the travails of one's life and all of one's striving and all of one's trying to be close and be good and be righteous and be loving and be caring and be merciful and be beautiful on the earth, all of these things lead us to God himself. God, therefore, is seen as Al-Wadud, the loving, and is one of God's names in the Quran, Al-Wadud, the loving, the one who loves unconditionally his creation, provides for his creation, the one who takes care of his creation without wanting anything in return. And what about creation? What about us? It is the desire that is expressed here. Closely related to that is another amazing name, and now we jump continents. So we've started in Africa, we went to South Asia, we came back up to Bosnia, and now we head all the way to Indonesia. Indonesia is a remarkable place. I've spent a lot of time in Indonesia because of some of the projects that my organization ran there. And one thing that I realized when I went to Indonesia was that it's like kind of looking glass Islam. I felt like Alice in Wonderland. Because everything is similar, but it's different. There's something that's not the same. And what you begin to realize is that in the most populous Muslim country on the planet Earth, Indonesian Islam is this remarkable mix of indigenous traditions, of Hindu and Buddhist traditions that came before it, and of course an Islamic framework which now contains it all. Indonesia is also a remarkable cultural space where men and women express themselves and express their faith in a remarkable variety of ways. This particular artist, Opik, has sold something like, his last album sold 800,000 albums. You can do that in a country of near 300 million people. Let's listen to Opik's Ya Hanan, Ya Manan. Sensibility. Almost poppy, but in an inoffensive way. It's a plaintive song. This is a song for the angst-ridden teenage Indonesian generation. You got to see the video for this. There's a lot going on in the video, man. There's like relationships breaking up. There's all kinds of domestic stuff going on. There's gang warfare in the street. It's pretty over the top. God, none other than you has power over me. You're the only place I can go to complain. In the weariness of my soul, I search for you. Thousands of hours, millions of moments. What could my faith be? I cry. Like it's helpless laughter. Oh, kind heart, make my heart kind. I bow to you. Oh Allah, oh merciful, oh benefactor. Cast aside the storms of my life. I'm helplessly waiting your destiny in hope of thy love. Maybe sounds a bit like Christian rock. I don't know.
Bagai tak berjaya di perjalanan dalam takdir.
So the name that comes to mind here is in the title. It's the benefactor, someone that one turns to in when one is completely downtrodden, when one has nowhere else to go. Again, the God who is closer to one than their jugular vein. He has a really beautiful voice, and I think. Once again, I chose a kind of a more modern piece because I felt that just as we find music that has sacred themes in our culture, I think in Indonesia it's really an emerging and a very massive market, and it's having a really profound effect because I've been to Indonesia and I've seen the rise of young youth movements where young people are really being influenced very positively by religion, and in some cases not so positively, but there's that kind of battle. And that battle is often being fought between extremisms and between normative Islam is being fought really through culture. And that's why in some ways songs like this and artists like this are actually really important because there's a context. These conversations are taking place within an incredible context. Finally, and we'll end on this, and we'll open the floor for some questions. We're going to come back to the Middle East, and I purposely kept the Arab world out of this until now, in a way because what one realizes when one looks at the diversity of a billion plus believers is that the cultural expression of Muslims and the way they express God and reach out to God and understand God is united by the same language, but certainly culturally different, and sensibilities are really different. What I'm going to play for you now is a poem which I love very much because it's very close to a tradition to which I'm very close to. It's by the poem itself was written by a saint in the valley of Hadramaut in modern-day Yemen. He was from a city called Tarim. Tarim is an ancient city, as you know, a Yemen, one of the most ancient civilizations in the world. This is a plaintive plea. And I want to end on this because at the heart of this is the name which I began with, which is the name that, in a way, belongs to me, Rahman, the Merciful. And this poem is called Ya Allah Bi Nadhra, and it's sung by two Hadrami from the valley of Hadramaut, two very famous singers. You'll hear that there's a slight difference in the way it's recited, more like a litany of remembrance than a song.
تداوي كل ما بي من أمراض سقيمة ألا يلا بنظرة من العين الرحيمة تداوي كل ما بي من أمراض سقيمة ألا يلا بنظرة من العين الرحيمة تداوي كل ما بي من أمراض سقيمة ألا يا صاح يا صاح لا تجزع وتضجر وسلم للمقادير لكي تحمد وتجار ألا يلا بنظرة من العين الرحيمة تداوي كل ما بي من أمراض سقيمة وكن صابر وشاكر ألا يلا بنظرة تكن فايز وظافر.
I want to read you part of the translation. I find it very beautiful and something I'd like to share with you. O God, send down your mercy by your gaze, a gaze that will cure all my ailments. O my friend, don't you be anxious and burdened. Leave everything to fate and you'll be praised and rewarded. And be servants who accept what has been decreed by their Lord, which He has fashioned. And reject you not the decree of God, the Lord of the throne. Be those who are patient and grateful. May you be successful and victorious, and be amongst those who have the secrets of God. That is, those who have hearts of light, pure from any discrepancy, pristine and refined. The world is a dejected, difficult place, and the life of this world is insignificant, it's short, and no one has greed for the world except those who are blind. No intellect, if a person has intellect, would not reflect on this. Reflecting that this world does not last, and sorrows are aplenty, and wealth is scarce, be amongst the blessed ones who are cautious of this world, and who prepare themselves for God. Oh, my eyes, pour from you tears that descend for a lover who has been sent. And it goes on. It's plaintive. In fact, the author of this poem himself was blind. Imam al-Haddad never saw. And it's often very interesting to me that some of the great mystics in our various traditions were blind, and yet they had incredible insight into the human condition. And when I go back into the old poetry and I find some of it and I learn the stories of the men and women who wrote it, I'm awestruck, because I realize that they're not writing, of course, from their minds, but they're channeling something very profound through their hearts. And the attribute that the poet is calling upon, of course, is the attribute of mercy. And if there was any thing that was emblematic of Islam that I would communicate as being emblematic of my tradition, would be mercy. God says that He placed His mercy over His wrath. That before every chapter of the Quran, we say, in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. And I believe that in the times that we live, it's this mercy that sustains us. It's the thing that is at the very heart of my faith, and I believe in your faith. And I believe that what all of our faiths share is this ardent desire to connect with the mercy of God and the merciful one. And in that perfect, inclusive mercy is a remarkable space where, in a way, titles and monikers and names get left behind, because in the tent of God's mercy, we are all accepted. And it's something that I speak about often with other Muslim activists in particular, because we live in often difficult times where we face difficult political issues. And often think to ourselves, well, what is it? What is that spirituality in this maelstrom of Islamophobia and violence and terrorism and separation and ill will and ill feeling and greed and avarice? And what is the spirituality that we need now? And I continuously turn and return to mercy and the words that extol the merciful and that grant us mercy. And in a very famous saying of the Prophet Muhammad, he said that the all-merciful will not grant mercy to those who are not merciful. Be merciful to those on earth, and the one in heaven will have mercy on you. Mercy is that attribute which we can, I believe, embrace with every fiber of our being. Mercy and care. And that to be in the world today, for me, is... if we are not agents of that, if I am not an agent of that, then there's something wrong with me. A few years ago, and I'm going to conclude on this. Thank you for being so patient. A few years ago, I attended the world premiere of a remarkable piece of music by British composer Sir John Taverner called The Beautiful Names. All of you will, I'm sure, know John Taverner much more than I do. In fact, this piece of music was my introduction to John Taverner. And I later learned that it came out of his reflection on these 99 names of Allah, of God, that are encoded in the Quran and the Islamic tradition. And he said that he actually, as a Christian, as a Catholic, took on a personal spiritual practice of dwelling on each of the names. And after dwelling on each of them over and over and over again, he said a piece of music, a piece of choral music, came to him. And I remember that night in Westminster Cathedral in central London where I sat as a Muslim, surrounded by people of all faiths, but mostly Christian friends and brothers and sisters, and listened in this magnificent cathedral to the names of God, which I had grown up with, recited and sung so powerfully that I was in tears for most of the hour that these names went on. For me, again, it was the remarkable moment of unity through diversity, that in our reflection on one another's traditions, something remarkable and beautiful can happen. And in a way, my sharing this morning, which is very experimental and a little bit haphazard because of my clear non-mastery of technology, is that in this tradition of John Taverner and the great women and men who have come before us and who live with us now, that we will find in the music of one another and the culture of one another and the spirituality of one another and the litanies of one another and the remembrances of one another and in the understandings of God. Because God, in his majesty and profound wisdom, for a reason, as created as diverse and different. I have no doubt about that. I wouldn't be a believer if I didn't believe that. And I believe, if I believe in anything, I believe this, that we have an opportunity now, more than any other point in our collective histories, where we can intimately share of each other and from each other and be with each other in our various traditions, but also together. And I think that is a remarkable thing which my parents may not have had an opportunity, your parents may not have had an opportunity to have, but we have it. And I think to myself, my God, what a magic moment we live in, that I can experience something that nobody else in my history has experienced. That to me is a remarkable thing. And I want to close off with a verse of the Quran, which is a verse that is often seen as the very center of the mystical Quran, the heart of the mystical Quran. It's called the verse of light. And I think that we all share a sense of light and clarity when we think of God. So the Quran says, in the Arabic it is, Allahu nuru samawati wal ard. God is the light of the heavens and the earth. The example of God's light is that of a niche in which there is a lamp. The lamp is in a glass. The glass looks like a brilliant star, and it is lit and is lit by a blessed tree, the olive, which is neither of the east nor of the west. Its oil is about to emit light even though the fire has not touched it. It is light upon light. Nurun ala nur, light upon light. God guides to God's light whomever God wills, and God describes examples for people, and God knows everything well. Let us be vessels, I hope, of God's light, light upon light, so that the darknesses that surround us and the hatreds and the greed and the avarice and the difficulties which we all, I am sure, are committed to facing and to dealing with and to ameliorating, that we have some blessing in that path. And I posit to you that it is in these beautiful names, even from whichever tradition you come from, that I hope you will find in this music and in these names, not just hope, but also inspiration in your own spiritual lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have maybe 6 minutes, I think.
Thank you very much, Abdul. Fascinating and beautiful.
Thank you.
I won't say much because we've only got a few moments, but we do have a mic here, and I think we've got about 5 minutes. So if we've got a question or two, come to... We've just got one mic, have we? That's two mics, one each side. Just come to the guys with the mic if you have a question.
Doesn't have to be a question, even just a comment, a disagreement, whatever you want it to be. And we'll take as many as possible, and then I'll be around afterwards. We can chat and meet and exchange.
Hi, can I just say thank you for your talk? I live near Bradford up in Yorkshire. I trained as a teacher in Leeds, an RE teacher. And every time I hear something about Islam or an image of Islam that comes across from the press, I don't recognize it. This morning I recognized the Islam I first learned about when I trained as an RE teacher, and a deep connection with that spirituality. So just a big thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hi, I work and minister in Bradford, where most of our primary schools now, the city anyway, are 90%+ Muslim kids. I go into my local primary school to sing with the kids, and it's finding the secular stuff. It would really help me to understand, if you could help me to do that, what is the reason for the kind of prohibition on tuned instruments, etc. Where does that come from? And are there ways in which I could try and work with the kids and with the staff to overcome some of those barriers?
That's a great question. I'll definitely... we'll take a few more, and then I'll definitely come to that. It's really, really quite important. Go ahead.
It strikes me a lot of the music you were showing us, popular music with a deep spiritual theme of the love of God. In the West, a lot of the music has the theme of the love of the self or the love of another person. I was wondering if you had any comment or insight as to the culture or the reasons behind that.
Both great questions. Let me address that one first, because I know time is short. I think most music in the countries and regions with Muslim majorities also extol the self and all that. I think modern music does that. In a way, there's nothing wrong with that. We love that music as well. I think what to me is interesting is that I think there's a spiritual truth that the root of all music is this longing and desire in the heart. I think that is there's kind of a spiritual genealogy of all music. I think what we're definitely seeing in a lot of Muslim societies is in many ways a reemergence, you know, in places like Indonesia, Bosnia, the reemergence of a sacred tradition, but that's always been there. I think where the interesting intersection is happening now is when contemporary and traditional music are meeting. I'm really into hip hop and rap, and I love it. And I certainly see that in, for example, the history of rap itself, we see the very much the African-American, Muslim, Islamic experience at the very heart of that. So in a way, I think it's artists now trying to capture both, being able to switch, being able to reflect life and self, yet at the same time being able to take a step back from it, withdraw from it, and remember where it all came from. And I you know, in modern music, artists like Mos Def, Yasiin Bey, are doing that beautifully. To some extent, people like Lupe Fiasco, Brother Ali, and others. But yeah, I think at the heart of that musical, you know, there's a lot of tensions that are right there, and I think they really. I think your question highlights that, and I think it's right there. It's happening. This question, and we can talk later as well if you'd like. You know, unfortunately, I call this a modern phenomenon. There's a really modern phenomenon. I hate to even label it conservatism, this literalism, whatever. I think this idea of the prohibition on musical instruments is relatively recent and current, and I think it has a lot to do with a lot of things, including the emergence of some more conservative trends. I think the ways to bypass that are through the voice and through drum, about which there is no real disagreement. In normative Muslim societies, wherever you go, I mean, talk about musical theory. The Arabs invented musical theory. They invented notation, the guitar. Pretty much the corpus of the basic stuff that makes modern music really came from the Persians and the Arabs. And really came out of a very Islamic and Muslim milieu. So in a way, I think there's a I think there is a historical reality to that. But I think the way we can get around is by introducing a kind of music that is voice and drum based, and then making a kind of a passionate, sensible, rational argument for the inclusion of more. And I think music is vital part of education, and in fact, in classical Islamic societies, one would not have been educated had one not known music, like in all classical societies. Yeah.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, so I just want you to show your thanks to Abdul for a fascinating, beautiful, spiritual session. Abdul, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.